A Gathering of Days. A New England Girl's Journal, 1830 to 1832. A novel by Joan W. Bloss. Chapter 9. Monday, March 21st, 1831. Although in memory sap runs fast, the actual accumulation is drop by drop and slow. Hardly any attended school. All help is needed that can be had to feed the fires and stir the kettles and join the speculation. Will it soon turn syrup? Tonight our father will stay at the camp to keep the fires going. Tuesday, March 22nd, 1831. Father says 'twas grand. Many friends and neighbors came out, and Sophie's father, Mr. Perkins, was there and had brought his fiddle. For nourishment, there was the syrup itself. One tastes its careful with sipping spoon or ladles some off, preserving the boil to pour on the clean white snow. The sudden chilling brings a thick waxy sugar, which is everyone's treat. Father says Cassie's brother David gave his dog a great thick lump which sealed the poor dog's jaws, so he can neither chew nor bark, both of which he now longed to do till it had dissolved away. A rather bad accident has befallen Joshua Nelson's mother. He tells that her cow raised its head up quick, thereby sticking a horn through her cheek and knocking her out completely. No one else was there at the time, so she took care of herself. Joshua says she's mending nicely. Mrs. Shipman, on hearing what happened, sent round some new baked loaves of bread and the last Thanksgiving pie. Thursday, March 24th, 1831. Warm, cold, and once again warm. There is consternation here lest the warmer weather bring an early end to the sap. Concerning the seasons, Father observes, till very nearly the same as with the seasons of men's lives. The baby not only crawls and creeps, but walks a step or two and falls, and then 'tis many weeks or months before the true achievement. The aging granddad sinks so low the family thinks him gone. Then is the oldster, up and about, spry and bright as you please. But this time is his time well and run. So when the next decline occurs, it carries him to the grave. And you, my girl, says Father to me, pressing his hands against his knees and rising from his chair, you've been a woman while yet a child. Well, we shall see if time or contrivance restore sweet youth to you. A chill passed over me at that. I yearned to protest that I was happy, would have it no other way. Something in his manner bade me hold my tongue. Let thy speech be better than silence, or be silent. Dionysius the Elder. Oh, forgive me. I'm sorry. I forgot to give you the date. My bad. Friday, March 25th, 1831. Let thy speech be better than silence, or be silent. Dionysius the Elder. Mrs. Shipman's receipt for mince meat. 1 pound of meat, suet, sugar, raisins, currants, each 6 large pippin apples, 1/2 pound citron, 1 ounce of cinnamon, 1 ounce of cloves, the same of nutmeg, 1 quart of brandy, and 1 quart of wine. Sunday, March 27, 1831. As feared, the sugaring was halted early by the quirky weather. That is ever the farmer's lot, who must be grateful when fortune smiles, resigned when she turns away. It is good that a new and lively topic is offered for conversation. Indeed, I think it fair to say that no one talks of anything else. Truly is Priest Fowle's sermon forgotten in this occurrence. This Tuesday past, we've learned An eloquent and elegantly appointed coach appeared in Meredith. It bore but a single passenger, a gentleman in foreign dress, who also, in perfect English, whether a Mr. Jeremy Preston still lived thereabouts. That is Sophie's granddad's brother on her mother's side. On being told Mr. Preston's location, the stranger said he had business with him, but would not reveal its nature. By nightfall, everyone knew. It happened that many years ago, a Reverend Williams bound out his youngest son to be the merchant Preston. One night, the boy returned late to his lodging, he having spent the evening in the company of girls. For this offense, he was whipped next day, as was to be expected. Nevertheless, the next night he ran off, taking with him some $300 from his employer's desk. The theft was discovered with the boy's escape, and he was traced to Portsmouth. There, his pursuers were utterly foiled. He had signed on with a Russian ship, and she had sailed that morning. Two dockside lads who'd helped put her out remembered the farm boy well. As has now been learned hereabouts, pirates attacked when the ship was mid-ocean, and the youth became a hero. For but for his wit and courage, too, the frigate would have been overrun and all its men taken captive. Upon arrival in St. Petersburg, the boy was made very much of indeed, and soon presented, his grace and charm exceeding, to the Tsar himself. Let me reread that. Upon arrival in St. Petersburg, the boy was made well much of indeed, and soon presented, his grace and charming exceeding, to the Tsar himself. In other words, he was presented to the Tsar. In time, he was made a nobleman, and not too long after, he was made an admiral in the Navy. Through all these years, he kept a secret, it pricking him from time to time, as a thorn or silver will, if it be not removed. So, when, in connection with his business affairs, a Boston visit must be arranged, the one-time runaway had resolved he would seek out the place of his indenture, his unhappy origins, and his youthful offense. Thus did he travel to Meredith in the hired coach, when resplendent he stood before the humble man whose service he'd escaped. The stranger announced most ringingly, "I, sir, am Count Zentcharoff of St. Petersburg." "Beg pardon, I know you not," the bewildered merchant replied. "Then do you remember the boy named Williams, to whom you gave a thrashing, and who then disappeared? He took $300, too. No doubt you remember that." At this, the old man remembered him well, but could make no sense of it all. But now the count took out his purse and asked the extent of his debt. "The extent of the debt, sir? Why, as you've said, 'tis but the $300 that you took from me." But remarking that had it lain in a bank, the money would have increased in time, he paid it all in golden coin. How it glinted in the sun, according to those who were there. Then he addressed the curious crowd. "Now, my countrymen, for so you are still, I go back to Russia as an honest man." Having thus fulfilled his obligation, he had no desire to tarry. He quickly stepped into the waiting coach and soon was out of sight. I scarce can believe this marvelous tale. Today the words are on every tongue. The Count of Meredith. Monday, March 28th, 1831. Joshua saw it, and he told Asa, and Asa told Cassie, and me. Teacher Holt and Aunt Lucy kissed, sitting together round the fire at the sugaring off. Wednesday, March 30th, 1831. I was the winner at spelling today, bringing down Joshua Nelson with A Company, A-C-C-O-M-P-A-N-Y. I think his mind was not on it, though. His error was such a foolish one, to neglect to double the C. He took his defeat in excellent humor and even told me, fairly won, when we met after school. April Fool's Day, 1831. Maddie and I played a great prank on our father this morning. Yesterday, on conceiving the trick, I pared down a firm white turnip to resemble the end of a candle. After we all had retired last night, and making sure he preceded us in sleep, we tiptoed down and with our candle, quote unquote, replaced the one he uses daily to start the morning fire. As soon as we heard a noise below, we scarcely slept a wink all night for fear that we should miss it. Maddie and I wrapped up in quilts and crept to the foot of the stair. He applied the flint for the longest time, but the candle, quote unquote, would not burn. It happened that the early dark helped preserve our secret. Although he peered at it several times, he did not detect the replacement. Now, indeed, did he lose his temper, calling on spirits of every sort, and cursing the damp of the springtime morning, which made the wick, or so he thought, so stubborn and refractory to the flint's persuasion. Excuse me, didn't mean to go off screen. Of course, in time, he took hold of the thing, and then the sport was out. We were helpless before our laughter. And though at first he pretended wrath, he quite soon joined in. The best prank ever, he then announced, and added with mock severity. But next time, thrashing awaits such sisters as make the father the fool. Morning, April 4th, 1831. This morning I had Matt put on a dress she hasn't worn for a season. Her poor little hands and wrists stuck out, and Father said he guessed he got two young ladies now. Now nothing will do, but we have new clothes, and I suppose we must. Father will fetch the yard goods home when he goes back to Boston. Already in the Concord paper, the local merchants advertise dress goods of summer weight. I faithfully mend whatever I can. Now am I ashamed to wear a garment when the patch is neatly done, the collar nicely turned. Nor am I ashamed to wear a garment when the patch is neatly done and the collar nicely turned. Yet now that he's put the thought in my head, I think of nothing else. I've been so long without a new frock. I suppose Cassie's mother will say of the cloth, remember, Charles, that blue shows soil and would not homespun do. But oh, I would love a darling blue dress, all cut to the latest fashion. The end of chapter 9.